Good evening. I'm Henry Banks, senior producer and host of People of Color on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up in a few minutes, award-winning Native Heritage artist Jonathan Thunder. Jonathan joins me to talk about his art and to share his personal journey. Also, it's Juneteenth time again. We share a 2017 interview from the RT Network. Their guest, activist Perry Rudd, explains Juneteenth and its importance. He's talking to Tyrell Ventura and Tabitha Wallace. They are hosts of the show. People of Color is produced by Elliot Swearing. Welcome to People of Color on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Henry Banks. Thank you for being with us tonight. I am so honored and delighted to have in the studio Jonathan Thunder. He's a very talented artist from Duluth, Minnesota. He has a studio there, and there's an upcoming show, and I just wanted our listeners to at least know about this show, exhibition. We're going to talk more about that. It's going to be held in downtown Duluth. Jonathan, thank you for being here and taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us today. You are an incredible artist.
Oh, thanks, Henry, and I appreciate you having me on the show. Sure. It's an honor to be here on your show today.
Thank you. I've seen some of your artwork and taken some of the artwork in, and as I said, very talented. Can you tell our listeners how you got started, really, as an artist, and some of your background?
Sure. Well, that's a long story, and I will give you the 5 or 10 minute version of it. I like to say that the tipping point was real early in the third grade when I had an assignment where it was a simple assignment. I was tasked to draw a smiley face and a frowny face, and I was sitting at the kitchen table while my mom made dinner, and I could not figure out what that looked like, how visually, to make my hand create that those symbols. And she took a break from cooking and came over and offered me a little assistance with it, and which I accepted. She drew a circle and made two little dots for eyes and made a smile, and then drew another circle and made two little dots for eyes and made a frown. And it's funny because in my little third grade mind, I remember it being like fireworks. It was, at that point, my mom was the most talented artist in the world, and I wanted to grow up to be just like her. And ever since then, I've had an interest in drawing that has probably surpassed my interest in a lot of my other hobbies, and that's carried throughout my elementary, high school years. In high school, I was given the advice, dangerous advice, from a career counselor that I should pursue a career in fine arts. So she gave me a pamphlet to the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And I put it in my pocket for a couple years while I went out into the workforce and worked at a really cozy cubicle job, answering phones and setting up conference calls for AT&T. And it was tons of money for a young kid, benefits. I was really comfortable, but I wasn't happy. I had a lot of money, but I didn't have any kind of job satisfaction. And one day I took a look at that pamphlet again after working there for a couple of years, and I decided that's what I was going to go do. So I knew that it was going to be a tough road, and I knew that I had to give up a lot of things. But I went and tried it. I drove, 1,700 miles to Santa Fe, New Mexico, to a place where I'd never been before. I didn't even know what it looked like. And it looks a lot different than other cities. adobe buildings and kind of an interesting landscape.
Was that one way, Jonathan? 1,700 miles one way?
1,700 miles one way from Minnesota to New Mexico. And I think, you know, I starved and it was tough, but I never looked back. It felt right, you know. And in fine art school, I kind of learned to do what I wanted to do. I learned to be, you know, kind of the artist that, at least at that stage of my, you know, young life when I was 22 years old, I kind of knew what it meant to sort of take on the mind state of somebody who was going to be an artist for a living. After that, I came back to Minneapolis after a few years in Santa Fe, New Mexico, to study animation, visual effects, motion graphics, which I thought would be a good way to couple my creative training with a marketable kind of career to kind of fill in the gaps. And I did that in Minneapolis for a while. In downtown Minneapolis, I worked at a studio where I created animations. And during that time, also sought exhibits to show my work. And I had a solo show. My first solo show was at Two Rivers Gallery in Minneapolis on 11th and Franklin. It's around the corner of Bloomington and Franklin at the American Indian Center there.
Sure.
And I remember feeling like, you know, it was sort of my opportunity to find out if all of my hard work was going to pay off, because it was a room full of my paintings that I had worked really hard on. I dumped my heart and soul into them. They were very personal works about my experience as a you know, a native growing up in, you know, an urban setting. And I showed up to the exhibit, and I was so nervous that I didn't want to go in. And I actually left. But I came back and mustered up the courage to go inside.
Oh, we're glad you came back. Okay, we're glad you came back.
Yeah, I was standing outside, and this guy comes out, and I said, "How's it going in there?" And he said, "Well, it's going good, except we haven't seen the artist." I said, "Oh, he's coming." So I go inside, and my heart's pounding, and I'm sweating, and I survived it.
That's a good story, man. That's a very powerful story, too. So you overcame that fear.
Yeah.
And look at you now.
First solo exhibit, I was super nervous, and, you know, it worked out.
You're listening to People of Color on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll be right back. I'm here with Jonathan Thunder. He is an award-winning, multidisciplinary artist. He currently resides in Duluth, Minnesota. I mean, incredibly talented. So I know you're being a little bit modest here, so I want you to just take go a little bit deeper for our listeners and talk about some of your works of art. And, you know, it says here on your bio that your works are all over the place.
Yeah. Well, let's go deeper. I like to be kind of an open book about my life. So that exhibit, that first exhibit, I remember I was a little, I guess I felt a little weird that, you know, I didn't sell any work at that show, and I didn't know why, because I knew that my work kind of had a place, you know, in the community, you know, the current Minneapolis art community that was there at the time. So I was a little confused. So fast forward to about a year later, I get offered another exhibit. It's with another artist. And I have only maybe a couple more paintings at that time, because I was, you know, I was still kind of like working on the digital stuff as well, too. And I looked at all my paintings and I thought, well, let's see, what did I do the first time? I priced everything, you know, at like $300 a painting, mm-hmm. $400 a painting, $500 a painting. And, I mean, what can I do different? So I took all the price sheets and I made everything that was $300, $3,000. I made everything that was $500, $5,000. And we went through with the show, and somehow in the same city, I sold a bunch of work. It was all the same work, just higher mm-hmm. prices. So that was really reaffirming for me, and a kind of a, you know, one of those weird like life lessons about the art world, where I learned that like you are the expert on the value of your work, you know, and you get to determine how hard you want to work on it and what you know want to market it as. Like, do you want to market it this way or that way? That's up to you. Mm-hmm. That you're totally in charge of that. So I went on to be, I knew that was going to be my career. I always knew it was going to be my career. And I ended up starting my own business not too long after that. So I was working in Minneapolis for myself and taking on animation projects. Some of them more artsy than others. Some of them were kind of commercial. And also doing exhibits in Minneapolis, and being my own boss, you know, I was kind of just setting my own hours and living my own, you know, living kind of to my own rules. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So for a long time, it seemed like I was on a path where, you know, I was looking to artists who are known for their great careers, but they burned out really young. You know, like some of my heroes, like Jean-Michel Basquiat and Jackson Pollock, T.C. Cannon, you know, who was an Institute of American Indian Arts legend. You know, these guys, they painted hard, but they also lived really hard. Mm-hmm. And that was the path that I was going down. And, you know, being... you know, living in Minneapolis and having that kind of career and having that kind of freedom, there was really nothing standing in my way, except for I just started to realize that it was, you know, that lifestyle was hurting me. You know, it was hurting my artwork, and it was hurting those people around me to kind of see me go through that. So I was spending more time in the bar than I was in the painting studio.
So Jonathan Thunder, let me ask you this. So you were going down a path, you said.
Mm-hmm.
What changed you as you were starting to go down this path? When did you realize you really had something and that you really wanted to focus on this craft, this skill, this incredible art that you constantly are producing? When did that light bulb come on, or when did the change happen to make you realize that you were really an important artist?
I would say that it has a lot to do with some of my friends that I knew through the, you know, the art community, you know, and a few family members who, you know, were nice enough to or brave enough, I'll say, maybe, because maybe nice isn't the word, to remind me, you know, that I was kind of endangering myself in a big way with living as hard as I was living. And they had to remind me a few times, and finally I started to realize that, you know, they wouldn't be saying this, you know, if there wasn't something to it. So I looked at this point, you know, I'm about 10 years into my art career, and I've worked, you know, and I've sacrificed a lot of things. I've sacrificed stability, relationships, you know, things like the ability to make a car payment, stuff like that, in order to pursue my career path. And I wasn't about to throw it all away. So, with the combination of just being, they say sick and tired of being sick and tired.
Yes, right.
I knew that I needed, you know, I needed to change something. So I ended up putting myself into rehab. And that was a scary path because you can't get in when you think you should. And when you think you should go is usually when you're in the most danger. So luckily for me, I was able to get in there. And they said, you know, we think that when you get out of here, there's a place in Duluth that, you know, we think you should go. And I was like, what? I'm not from Duluth. Mm-hmm. Why would you, what makes you think I want to go there? And they said, exactly, you're not from Duluth. So we're going to send you there. We think you'll like it. And I popped out on the other side of that little journey, which was amazing, in Duluth, Minnesota. And I was staying at a place, you know, it was kind of like, you know, a place where they just look out for you until you sort of get on your own two feet. And I was in Duluth for about 3 months, and then I got a studio at the Washington Studio Artist Co-op. And that was an amazing opportunity for me because it was a huge space. You know, I had a clear head. I was next to Lake Superior, which was super awe-inspiring. And I hadn't really had a chance to make any art for a long time. So I had a ton of ideas and nothing really standing in my way at that point. So, you know, I just started producing work, like work after work. And, you know, I still had my network, you know, in the art world in Minneapolis. And I had some connections here in Duluth or in the Twin Ports area because I had done some shows at the University of Superior, Wisconsin in mm-hmm. the Kruk Gallery mm-hmm. With Ivy Vigno as the curator. And she had introduced me to some folks at ACO who I had exhibited over there back in like 2012. So
and ACO is the American Indian Community Housing Organization.
Yes.
That's located in downtown Duluth, right?
Yep.
Yes, okay.
Yeah. So, you know, I had some connections and I actually, you know, I just had some help getting back on my feet from a couple friends that I knew through the art community who believed in me. Little bit of funding for some canvases and stuff like that. And I just started painting, you know, and
so cool.
As they say, the rest is history.
The rest is history. You're listening to People of Color on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll be right back. I'm here with Jonathan Thunder. He is an incredible artist, award-winning. And as I look at your bio, something jumps out at me. So in your bio, it says that you seek to create imagery that is surreal and imaginative by incorporating influences from the structure of your dreams, the culture around you, and the direction your life is headed on any given day. Okay, so that's how it kind of describes your work.
All right. Yeah, I'm always impressed with some of my writing.
Yeah, right.
Like, I wrote that? Cool. Yeah. But so what I would imagine that means is, I just paint what I know. You know, I am not like highly academic. You know, I didn't take on any one, like political cause or, environmentalist cause. I just know that my experiences in life have brought me down a very, specific path. Being, a Red Lake Ojibwe who grew up in Minneapolis, who, deals with historical trauma, some setbacks from cultural, challenges.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then in the face of that, you know, trying to be an artist who has a message that's creative and unique and isn't just about hopelessness, mm-hmm. but about hope. Mm-hmm. Because when I paint, you know, I paint from my experiences, which haven't always been great, but they haven't always been bad, you know, and I tune into my dreams. I tune into the artwork of surrealists. I tune into, you know, movies that I love. And it all influences my work, and I just try to paint honestly.
Well, Jonathan, I want to go back a little bit here. So you just said something that it's not about hopelessness, but hope.
Hope.
So say there's a young Native Heritage person or several listening to the show right now. Can you talk more about the hope? Especially through the struggles that you've had and you've overcome all of the obstacles that were in your way. Can you help a young Native Heritage person or anyone who might be listening to the show that need to hear something positive in their lives?
Yeah. Well, let's see. What can I say? I like to look back at my parents, you know, as the beginning they... they lived on the Red Lake Reservation and had about as much opportunity as anybody there. My dad went through a little bit of boarding school experience, and my mom lived in a house. They called it the Tin House, where there was just like the wind just blew through the walls because it had mm-hmm. holes in it. But they said, we're gonna try something, and she went to school and wound up being an accountant for Head Start program, and wound up being the executive financial director of all the Head Starts in the nation after a little while. And my dad was a truck driver for 30 plus years, and he paid the bills, and at night he was home and he was pops. So, I think that for me, let me know that, there's, if there's hard work, that you do, there's, probably going to be some kind of light at the end of the tunnel for that. So that's what I did with my career. I created a path for myself, and it was a daunting path. Most people wouldn't say, for stability and, a profitable life, I'm going to go be an artist. But, I worked hard, and I feel like, I do pretty good. Mm-hmm. I do all right.
And, we need to get rid of those notions that are out there that say in many communities that our Native Heritage families aren't together, our African Heritage families aren't together. Your parents were with you. Your parents were resilient through whatever it was that your family might have been going through at that time. They stayed together. They were there for their children. And so it's about telling the truth about who we are as people, as Native Heritage people, as African Heritage people, mm-hmm. that our families are together.
Yeah.
But what you see on TV is that, or in other media, that our families aren't together. And so we need to change that attitude about how people see us as well. Would you agree to that?
I would agree to that. I think it's, the family structure is, it can be found too, like if you look for it. As a teen, I managed to take a lot of my challenges. Like I went to Brooklyn Center High School, and the racism there just drove me insane.
Mm-hmm.
Like I had to leave there and go to a school where I was more accepted, Center School Inc. on 24th and Bloomington, which was right next to the Indian Projects. And, I found a community there, and they got me through it. So, we do have a lot of community around us now that are making great movements, in the world. And whether it's like going down to a community center like ACO or something like that and just being a part, volunteering, or just having influence from them, that can make a huge difference on, somebody who's maybe feeling a little hopeless.
Yeah.
Or maybe they have some bad influences that are sort of pulling on them a little harder than the good ones.
Yeah, they're doing some wonderful work at ACO. They absolutely are. So I asked you to come to the show to talk about some of your life experiences, but also to talk about an upcoming exhibition that you are going to be in. That's kind of going to be opening here very soon. I know you're going to be in the exhibition with Zamara Kuyun.
Kuyun.
She is a self-taught artist of the de-indigenized Highland Maya ancestry. That sounds interesting. And so you're going to be with her. If you want to talk a little bit about some of her work and some of your work that you're going to be displaying in the exhibition, how long will the exhibition go for? And it's going to be at ACO in downtown Duluth. When it's going to be opening up? I know there's a reception coming up soon. Can you talk about some of that?
Yeah. I'm still getting to know Zamara. I was paired with Zamara as a good fit by Miri Villiard at ACO, who is acting as the curator. Miri is also a very talented painter, poet, amongst other things.
Yeah, she's been on the show also.
But in this role, she's sort of pairing us up together to do an exhibit. And I took a look at Zamara's work, and it's dark and beautiful and kind of mythical and dreamlike. And I could immediately see why Miri would put us together, because that's sort of the aesthetic that I like to tell my little stories through as well. And I can see that Zamara is an artist who is not going to sugarcoat things, you know, as far as like the challenges that her community is facing or has come from. You know, she's definitely created some powerful imagery in some of the examples that I've seen, and I'm really looking forward to seeing her work in person. So I think together our two bodies of work side by side are going to be, you know, it's going to be a bit of truth, a bit of hope, and, you know, a bit of magic.
Truth, hope, and magic. That's awesome. When is it kicking off?
So the exhibit is set to open on May 24th.
Friday, May 24th. Okay. That's interesting. Friday, May 24th, and there's going to be a reception, I believe, correct?
Yeah. Okay. So we'll be having a reception from 5:30 to 7:30 at the Dr. Robert Paulus Cultural Center, which is in Central Hillside at the American Indian Community Housing Organization. There'll be paintings. We'll say a few brief words, but there won't be an artist talk that night. We're going to schedule an artist talk for probably sometime in June, where people will be invited to come down and ask about the work, because I think some of the work that you'll see is going to be pretty heavy, thought process wise, and some of it's kind of cryptic because it's got that dreamlike nature to it. So we're going to give people a chance to ingest it and then come down later and ask us some questions, and we'll see if we can come up with some cool answers.
How many pieces are you going to have in the exhibition?
I'm probably going to have about a half a dozen pieces. My pieces are very, pretty big. Mm-hmm. You know, I got a hold of some 7-foot canvases recently that I've been having a lot of fun with. And, I just now started putting together the two parts of a diptych, which is, 8 feet wide. So once that's all framed up and ready to go, that'll be my probably final edition to the work, and then those will take up at least half the gallery.
Well, that is awesome. That is really cool. So our show has a lot of listeners over in the Ashland and Bayfield area. Why don't you say something to them to encourage them to come to your exhibition? Why they should come from Ashland to see your works?
Well, let's see. Not really familiar with the Ashland and Bayfield area quite yet. Although I do know, so I would say there's a Comic-Con that I have heard of that happens in Bayfield, Wisconsin. And one of the influences that I've taken on in my artwork is from comic books. So a lot of my characters are sort of my own little superheroes that I create for myself. And it's said that my painting style is a little graphic, like you might see in a graphic novel, which I love graphic novels. So if you're into that aesthetic, you know, if you're into that sort of superhero theme, I probably have something that you might enjoy, and I'd be happy to tell you about it if you stop by.
Absolutely. That's perfect. So the exhibition is going to go through the month of June, but the opening is on Friday, May 24th from 5:30 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. in the Dr. Robert Paulus Cultural Center. That's the American Indian Housing Community Housing Organization. They're located downtown. For more specifics, they are in the former YWCA building in downtown Duluth, a wonderful organization that is putting this together. Great leadership at ACO, doing just some incredible work as well. Jonathan, I am so grateful that you took the time to just come and be with us today to talk about some of your life story, your artwork. Is there anything else you want to leave with our listeners to encourage them to come and be a part of this exhibition?
Yeah, absolutely. So a lot of the work that we'll be focusing on, I think, I mean, I can always speak for myself for sure. And I see a bit of it in Zamara's work as well, is about some of these really exciting movements that we see happening in the indigenous community today with the revitalization of indigenous foods. My wife, Tashia, is what I would call one of the she's a very strong advocate of the indigenous food movement and stays highly active, you know, in some of the events that are being organized, not only around Minnesota, but around the country. And, you know, she's been a good influence on me as far as like seeing the positivity in that, you know, and the value in it. There's been a lot of sort of cultural revitalization that happens with language, you know, because language was something that was made illegal for many years. Culture was something that was made illegal for many years. And it was replaced with something that was given. So there's a lot of good organization now as far as inviting people back. And some of my work covers that, those movements that are now happening, which, you know, are great because they help eliminate cultural shame and stuff like that, that, you know, has been, spoon fed to us through movies, through propaganda, through cartoons, and anywhere you can get it in American entertainment and history, you know, the shaming of the, you know, American Indian community has been a pretty good propaganda scheme. So there's a lot of movements now that are kind of like putting value back into it. And you see a lot of people showing up to these events, you know, and that's a lot of the stuff that I like to cover in my work. Because that's the hope, you know, that's the stuff that's happening. That's the showing up, you know, that our communities are doing together. And when you show up, you know, like great things happen.
Wow. Keeping that very positive, keeping hope as yeah. One of the number one things, I think that's real important. That's helpful, hopefully, for those listening. Folks, you will come to this incredible exhibition that opens on May 24th at 5:30 p.m. in the ACO, Dr. Robert Paulus Cultural Center area of that facility. Your wife, Tashia, mm-hmm. is equally as gifted and talented as you are.
I agree.
You know?
I'm her number one fan.
I guess I'm number two. Okay? So, but I just wanted to mention that your wife is very, very talented as well.
Thank you. Yeah, she's a great artist and a writer.
Yes, absolutely. So thank you again for coming in. Jonathan Thunder, artist extraordinaire from Duluth, Minnesota, from the Twin Ports. Folks, we just don't know how many incredibly talented people of color and Native heritage people we have. Let's go out and support this upcoming exhibition. Thanks for listening to People of Color on Wisconsin Public Radio. Have a great evening and a great weekend. You're listening to People of Color on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to People of Color. Coming up next, the host of Watching the Hawks, Terrell Ventura and Tabitha Wallace, have a conversation with civil rights activist Perry Redd. Mr. Redd discusses the history behind the celebration of Juneteenth in the United States and the acquittal of the police officer who killed Philando Castile. This is from 2017. I thought it was an important conversation to share again right here on the show. That's coming up right now. And folks listening to the show, I wanted to give you the date for the upcoming Juneteenth celebrations in the Twin Ports. The first celebration is on June 15th. That's at 12 noon in the Central Hillside Park in Duluth, Minnesota. That location is Lake Avenue and East 4th Street. June 16th in Superior, Wisconsin. That's at Kelly Park from 2 p.m. to 7 p.m. And Kelly Park is located at 711 Grand Avenue. Those are the two Twin Ports Juneteenth celebrations, Saturday, June 15th in Duluth, and Sunday, June 16th in Superior. Thank you.
On September 22nd, 1862, President Abraham Lincoln issued the Preliminary Emancipation Proclamation Order, which declared all persons held as slaves within any state or designated part of a state, the people whereof shall then be in rebellion against the United States, shall be then, thenceforward, and forever free. But it would take another 2.5 years before the news and the idea of freedom reached people in some southern states. By the time Major General Gordon Granger took command of the Department of Texas, Lincoln was dead and the 13th Amendment abolishing slavery was about to be ratified. The last of the holdouts, people who just wouldn't let go of their desire to enslave human beings, needed to be told once again that the days of slavery were over. On June 19, 1865, Major Granger dispatched this now famous Order Number 3, in which he declared, "The people of Texas are informed that in accordance with the proclamation from the executive of the United States, all slaves are free. This involves an absolute equality of personal rights and rights of property between former masters and slaves, and the connection heretofore existing between them becomes that between employer and hired labor." But it wasn't easy. Transition from a country that built its foundations on slave labor and indentured servitude to put it behind them. In fact, we still haven't managed to remove slave era policies and ideology from all of our government and society like weeds in a garden. Racism and slavery are constant reminders that we are a young, developing nation still finding its legs as a culture, which is why the order by Major Granger on June 19, 1865 is still so significant today. Known as Juneteenth, it became an official holiday in Texas in 1979 and is now an official holiday in 42 states and the District of Columbia. Joining us now to discuss the significance of Juneteenth is activist Perry Redd. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Perry, always a pleasure. Now, I want to get you into Juneteenth and tell me what is the soul of Juneteenth and why is this such an important holiday for the United States to, as a society and as a country, to recognize?
Yeah, well, Juneteenth, the foundation is based in emancipation, basically being freed from a former held state, a slave state. And that's a state of being between human beings in a relationship. This country is still having difficulties with a form of colonialism. I'm a resident of the District of Columbia, and even though many of us, over 600,000 of us, reside on the mainland, we still don't have the same rights as many other Americans. We lack statehood, and so that's a form of a lack of emancipation. The significance for America is chiefly three things. One, reminding us of where we've been and where we need not return. And unfortunately, we have many who are nostalgic to go back to the quote-unquote good old days. And we ask the question, good old days for whom? Some want to take their country back. And the good thing is there's a resistance there. And then another piece of that puzzle of what it means to America is to remind America of a legacy that was built in violence, that was built in oppression, and to let America know that America and the world know that this country is not necessarily exceptional. American exceptionalism is a false premise. And then the third piece of this puzzle, chiefly, is to get to a place where we can truly identify this country's history and be honest with one another, black, white, or indifferent.
Yeah. One of the things I always think is interesting is this idea that the Emancipation Proclamation just made all slaves free and that was the end of it. But in reality, it not only took a really long time for it to even reach certain states or do that stuff that we were just talking about, but in certain areas, more importantly, what it did was authorized black men who had been slaves or were free men to fight in the war. That was a major part of it. And it was kind of sold to people as, this will help us sell to the American people or to the rest of the citizens that they've earned this right to be here. As if being enslaved, they still had to prove themselves. Is that gone, or are we still kind of underlying have this idea that as black Americans, you have to prove that you're real Americans?
As you finish that question up, that is the answer to this thing, that we're still not there yet. We've all been in through our school systems ever since 1865 and the 12 years of Reconstruction following the abolition of slavery. We have been taught through the beginnings, freedmen schools to right now, charter school movement, a bill of goods that are counterfeit. And that's that story of the emancipation, on the reasons why. If indeed this country is righteous as children of God, then we have set you free, not mentioning those underlying reasons, whether they be economic or whether they be for the purpose of, I guess, keeping the Union together. The Union's never been together and isn't together, and we see that evidenced by our ideological battles today.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to, you know, I think one of the great examples of what you know, black Americans are facing today is the verdict that just got handed down over the weekend with Philando Castile. I mean, this is just another in a long line of dead young black men who will not have justice. You know, their killers are walking free, they're paid by the state, you know, somewhere on, you know, disciplinary action, but whatever, and a lot of times they're commended for their actions. Why is it that we are still clinging to a century and a half old ideas of policing, since modern police, not too many people know this, modern police evolved from runaway slave patrols, even their badges. I mean, you know, it's right here in our faces, that history that we don't want to pay attention to, and why are we still clinging to it?
Well, this glorified history of plantation owners hiring these or contractors, for a more modern term, to police between plantations in the period following slavery was simply another form of slavery, which we know as Jim Crow. And this idea of policing was meant at that time, over 150 years ago, during the period after slavery was abolished, it was meant to protect the oligarchs of this country, those who had plantations, still had plantations, and some who didn't have plantations or had them taken from them by the North. Some were given their plantations back, but the fact is those that owned resources protected them with these police forces. Not too far removed from today, when we looked at the North Dakota Access Pipeline battle, we saw these private paramilitary forces protecting the resources which would make some people rich in this country. And of course, it's going to keep others poor.
Yep.
And it goes back to even the Pinkertons and that. There's been a long, you know, it's like Blackwater wasn't a new concept. This has been a concept. It's hired goons, and you send
stage
hired goons.
Coaches.
Yeah, it's this idea that you can do that. And going back to this idea of how disparate, even on basic constitutional, I mean, the Philando Castile case to me pointed out something pretty glaring. He was a legal gun owner. He did everything he's supposed to. He was the right kind of gun owner. Mm-hmm. He was absolutely responsible. But apparently his Second Amendment rights disappear because of the color of his skin. Yep.
That's the way it looks. And let me just say, you know, one of the issues we have in this country when we talk about the values that Americans hold, equality, justice, freedom, democracy, dot, dot, dot. Well, Orlando Castillo, Officer Yanez, the officer who shot and killed him, shot him 7 times, said that he had a broad nose. And that's how he figured this was the suspect they were looking for. Never mind, he was in a car at 9 at night, and he was behind him when he pulled the... So how a jury of 10 whites and 2 blacks could acquit this officer is far beyond any of us, except for those who are extremely cynical about the American justice system. And we teach that system to others all across the globe through USAID or other entities. And that self-righteousness should never fly when we're teaching our system.
Yeah. Now, you know, we celebrate Juneteenth and we recognize the battle, but it seems harder to really, you know, for a lot of people to recommit themselves to ensuring freedom day after day after day, especially when presented with, you know, case after case and setback after setback. How do we as a society keep fighting this institutionalized racism here when it seems like we're never going to really, I mean, when you look at it, it's like, is this battle ever going to be won? And what keeps, you know, what keeps you going and what gives the movement strength? What keeps it moving?
Well, what keeps a movement are young people. That is the chief resource of any change in any society. I have 14 grandchildren, young people. And so as they grow, the oldest is only 16. So, you know, I'm from newborn to 16, I have the opportunity to instill in them a true American value system. Now, this is a country which was stolen from another group of people. And so to teach all of those values of remembering true history, not repeating the downfalls and failures, and remembering that we are all fallible, truly fallible. That way, it keeps us humble when we have relationships with others. It's very, very helpful that we've had many that have come before us who have sacrificed their lives, true martyrs, for the sake of justice and equality. We have to remember that, but the most important element is education.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is, Perry. I want to thank you so much for coming on and educating us today on Juneteenth and also and that holiday and the struggle. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure. Yes.
Freedom. Happy Juneteenth. Oh, freedom over me and before I be a slave. I'll be buried in my grave and go home to my Lord and be free. Oh.